Hello, good morning. All right, so I'm going to talk about Supernova Remnant G299 a little bit. First of all, I have to give a lot of credit to my grad student, Seth Post, who actually did almost all of this work. And also, I'd like to thank Gloria Duffner, who provided her H1 data cube to help us. Okay, then. Because G299 is one of the less known remnants, so I decided to start with a little bit of introduction, some background. Now, actually, G299 is one of the few supernova remnants that were discovered in the X-ray band rather than in radio. Actually, in other wavelengths, this remnant is really faint. And initially, it was identified to be a very young nearby supernova remnant. This is the image by the Rosette PSPC. The X-ray emission is pretty much all thermal. There's no sign of pulsar wind nebula. And then this morphology was identified to be either centrally peaked or partial shell. It's not really clear. But right after this initial discovery, it was found that the foreground absorption was relatively large, so the distance must be much farther than 500 parsecs, probably several kiloparsecs from the sun, and so the age was correspondingly modified to be mid-age, several thousand years. Actually, the distance was this distance was not a direct measurement; it was just it had a lot very large uncertainties. For example, if you use the radio sigma d relation, although radio remnant is really faint, so the uncertainties are even larger, but a very far distance was not able to be ruled out. It could be the other side of the galaxy. But even with the reasonable distance of several kiloparsecs, or 5 kiloparsecs to be specific, quite low explosion energy was estimated, close to 10 to the 50 Earths instead of 10 to the 51. So that was pretty much where we stood until we did our initial Chandra observations. This is our 30 kilosecond Chandra ACES S3 observations, and clearly resolved the shell, actually the multiple shell structures with subsolar abundances. So it's apparently expanding into a non-uniform ambient medium. Actually, these bright knots are just high-density regions, and that was the reason why the low-resolution image looked like partial shell or the centrally peaked. If you take a look close central part of the remnant, you can see a very faint nebulosity, and actually that's the reverse-shaped Bernoulli-Chi ejecta, showing strong enhancements in the iron, L, silicon, and Circle K lines. And there's no sign of oxygen or neon. Just for comparison, I don't know if you can see it, there's a faint spectrum, typical for the outer shell, which shows a much smoother subsolar nature. So based on this ejecta composition, we identified as type 1A supernova. And assuming the same 5 kiloparsec distance suggested by previous works, we confirmed that low explosion energy, although the distance can be much further, such as 10 kiloparsec, then the more canonical explosion energy was still possible. But anyway, if this remnant is not really far away, unless the long distance is the case, it seems that this is a subenergetic type 1A supernova exploded in a non-uniform interstellar medium. So that sounded quite interesting. However, as you can see, this data is very shallow. The data quality is limited, and particularly we missed a large part of the remnant because we used ACES S3 as the main detector. So we went ahead and did a very deep Chandra observation, 640 kiloseconds. This is one of the Chandra LP. with this time ACES IRA to make the full coverage. And this image is actually made by the nice work by Chandra EPO team. I tried, but I could not make this nice image. So thank for the Chandra EPO team. So we published our initial results from this deep data in 2014, a couple years ago, and we are still actually working on this data set. We so have not completed our work yet, so I'm going to show you some of the results that we have got so far, particularly focusing on the ejecta, the reverse shock ejecta distributions and the energetics. So once you got this new data, it was clear that we immediately see the almost circular-shaped central reverse shock metal rich ejecta. But also, it is very clear that the central bluish emission extends toward all the way out to the westernmost outer boundary. And that feature can be seen better in some of these line images. The left-hand side is the silicon K line equivalent width images showing the central enhancements and then extension to the west. This is the line ratio maps between silicon and oxygen and magnesium. I use oxygen and magnesium because they mostly follow the outer shell of the swept up medium rather than the central ejecta. This is the iron line equivalent width. It's actually iron L lines showing strong concentration at the center. So if you compare silicon and iron distribution, even in the main part of the central nebulosity, you clearly see the differences between north and south of the central part. So these line images shows that the enhanced line emission or likely the central metal rich ejecta gas show non-spherically symmetric distribution. I'm going to show you several actual spectra, X-ray spectra from several characteristic representative regions. First, the outer shell, as I said, X-ray spectrum shows relatively smooth distribution, although it clearly shows several lines. All those elemental abundances are pretty much subsolar, consistent with the swept-up interstellar medium origin. And I took spectra from these three representative regions of the central nebulosity. All of these spectra shows very different line structures, strong enhancements in iron L, silicon, and sulfur in all of these regions. And actually, majority abundances are very high, overabundant ejecta material, and particularly see in the northern half of the northern part of the central nebulosity, as the line equivalent with images suggested, so, the iron abundance is relatively higher compared to the other two regions, and where in the south of central and the western extent shows exactly the same abundance ratios between silicon and iron. With that in mind, we try to make a more quantitative assessment on the spatial distribution of metal rich ejecta based on the statistics. So this is what we did. This is pretty straightforward. We divided the entire remnant into a number of small regions using an adaptive mesh to collect at least 1,500 counts. So these little boxes shows almost 1,600 subregions. And then we fit the spectrum from each individual region with the NEI plane shock model, assuming the outer shell abundances. So this is the reduced chi-square map. Okay. So here in the regions with dark or brownish regions show a good chi-square, reduced chi-square values around 1, which means those regions are well fitted by the shell abundances, so subsolar regions. And whereas in the central part, mostly white regions showing very poor chi-square, reduced chi-square above 2, which means those regions cannot be filled by the subsolar shell abundances, so likely a overabundant Dvoriak ejecta. And you can clearly see this suggested morphology, almost circular ejecta nebulosity at the center and extended all the way out to the western outer boundary. Actual abundance distributions are like this. Actually, I show you a couple of example directions. The south southern sector shows as blue data point. Actually, these are the iron and silicon abundances. Radial profile, this is the center, and this is outer shell. This is right y-axis is the abundances. And western sector is shown as the red data points. So it's clear that in the southern sector, the abundances, measured abundances, quickly drops down to the shell values at about 2 arc minutes, right there. That corresponds to the outer boundary of the central nebulosity. Whereas the western profile shows significantly more extended, overabundant material, pretty much all the way out to the outer boundary. So that's clearly demonstrate the particular shape of the projected ejecta distribution. Another issue was the energetics in this remnant. The main problem was the distance measurements. So what we wanted to do was the H1 absorption measurements to constrain the distance to this remnant. However, unfortunately, again, G299 is really, really thin in X-ray, so we could not really measure the H1 absorption. But the H1 flux distribution along the velocity range shows strong concentrations in the negative velocity ranges. These two peaks actually corresponds to the two spiral arms along the line of sight. And this is the galactic rotation curve, and all the negative velocity components of the H1 cloud. Here, this is the radial velocity, and x-axis here, the distance from the sun, all corresponding to the material within about 8 kiloparsecs, so within the solar circle. So what we did was to accumulate or add up all these H1 flux in the negative velocity range, and estimate the total H1 column up to 8 kiloparsec. So that is about 5 times 10^21 per square centimeters. And we estimated about 3 times 10^21 per square centimeter of the total H column based on our Chandra data. So we think that 8 kiloparsec is a nice upper limit. Actually, we think this should be a conservative upper limit for the distance to G299. So even though we still do not know the distance to G299, I think we can probably safely exclude the long distance scenario, so we can stay with the 5 kiloparsec distance range. And then, this is our estimate of the contact discontinuity based on all those ejecta analysis. And assuming 5 kiloparsec, and we estimate the total ejecta mass, particularly we're interested in the iron mass, that happens to be about 0.2 solar mass, which is quite low. And of course, the low explosion energy, based on the simple Seebeck solution, is there. And also, since assuming the main part of the contact discontinuity of the ejecta is relatively, before going to that, when we measure the iron mass, we assume a spherical volume for the main part of the ejecta and a cylindrical volume for the western extent. Now, assuming this main circular contact discontinuity, we use the ratios between the foreshock and the contact discontinuity radii, and apply a very simple one-dimensional dynamical model of Sonneberg remnant evolution to estimate the total ejecta mass. Here we use two different scenarios, assuming foreshock at this bright inner shell and the faint outer shell, because we do not know what's the, actually probably those present the projective two outer boundary of torsion. Depending on those two scenarios, we estimate the total ejecta mass as, there are some ranges, but in any case, it should be smaller than about one solar mass. We did another comparison, this time with the Churov-McKee model. Assuming, again, two cases, inner shell force shock and outer shell force shock with corresponding ambient density. And we assume two representing cases of canonical explosion with 1.4 chandrasekhar mass of ejecta and a low explosion energy with one solar mass ejecta. And here's the box. The box shows our measured force shock location and the age. And the model shows that actually this is in both cases the low energy with low ejecta, total ejecta mass scenario are consistent with our measurements. In the inner shell case, reverse shock has already reached the center of the remnant. And this is the main difference. For outer shell, reverse shock probably has not reached the center yet. But in terms of the energetics, they are all consistent with the low energy, low ejecta, and low projectile mass case. So for the rest, for the remaining a few slides, I'm going to put more questions than answers, unfortunately. So we are interested in the origin of this asymmetric ejecta distribution. Obviously, one possibility is the explosion was not spherically symmetric. In fact, particularly in recent years, a lot of 1A explosion models predict non-symmetric explosions. But I was wondering if any of these, I mean, if there's any specific models that can predict this particular morphology of ejecta gas, especially after several thousand years, making these peculiar shapes, at least in projection. Or the explosion was probably spherically symmetric, but the ejecta was expanding into non-uniform medium. This is one suggestion by, we made in 2007. So probably the supernova, actually we suggest this one to explain the multiple outer shell, not for the ejecta, of course. Supernova probably exploded at the boundary, near the boundary of the density gradient. And we are looking at this is line of sight. We see two different sides of the force shock along the line of sight, projected along the line of sight. Probably the face on view of the famous VRO42 case. This is an axion view. Here, the contours are radial shells showing two different outer shock boundary and central. Image is the X-ray ejecta. Again, however, the main density in this scenario, the main density gradient is along the line of sight, whereas the ejecta distribution is across the plane of sky. So it is not clear if this scenario can explain the observation. Or, one more slide. Or the ejecta expansion was through the modified circumstellar medium. Actually, earlier today, Norm Socker did a nice spoiler. They noticed that the there's eel-like features on either side, and they probably produced by the planetary nebula, and the ejecta is probably after explosion channeled through the bipolar planetary nebulae. However, again, ejecta flow is detected only toward one direction, not bipolar. So that's, again, a question. So I'm pretty much done. So as I said, I try to focus on the asymmetric distribution, apparent distribution of ejecta. That's the potential explanation is the asymmetric, non-spherically symmetric explosion. And the energetics shows a sub-energetic explosion, probably such as the sub-chandrasekhar explosion of type 1A. However, there's still, I put question marks there. One of the things we have not considered in terms of the energetics is the cosmic ray effect. There's no sign of synchrotron radiation at the current data, but in the past it could produce a lot of cosmic rays to affect the apparent energetics. Still, independently, the measured ion mass is pretty low. However, depending on the actual volume of the central ejecta material, it may also change, particularly the structure along the line of sight. So I think these are potentials, but still I have a way to go. Okay, I'll stop here.
You. You've shown spectra in the central region with temperatures of 1.3, 1.5 kV and NMS iron abundances. Have you detected iron K lines from this object?
No.
Even in the integrated region of the center?
Can you?
Even in the, when you integrate all the emission in the center?
Not really. It is really difficult. The entire spectrum is very soft. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. Let's thank our speaker again.